Ben and Jerry's has always been committed to an insanely ambitious three-part mission, making the world's best ice cream, supporting progressive causes, and sharing the company's success with all stakeholders. That means employees, suppliers, distributors, customers, cows, everybody. But it hasn't been an easy road, always. Journalist Brad Edmondson tells the story in his new book, Ice Cream Social, The Struggle for the Soul of Ben & Jerry's. He interviewed dozens of key figures, particularly Jeff Furman, who helped Ben & Jerry write their first business plan way back in 1978 and became chairman of the board in 2010. It's a great pleasure to welcome Brad Edmondson to the roundtable. Thank you very much for being with us. I appreciate it.
Thanks for having me.
It's nice to have you here. This is a fascinating story. It's very much a local story. I mean, Ben and Jerry, they went to school in Skidmore in Saratoga and was one of their first shops, and then obviously took Vermont by storm.
I think they opened their store in Schenectady in 1982.
Wow. Yeah.
And so this was one of the first Ben & Jerry's ice cream stores was in the capital region.
In the market. What was it that drew you to the story of wanting to tell the story?
Well, there's two things about this story that really hooked me in, and I spent a couple of years on it full time because it was such a deep and interesting, complicated story. One is it really is a way of looking at the growth of what's called corporate social responsibility in the United States. This company was sort of at the forefront of that movement for a couple of decades and took its lumps as it got bigger and moved through all the different stages of the movement. And then the other thing is that there's this core issue that all entrepreneurs face who build their businesses for a reason that goes beyond making money, which is, how do you sell the business without giving up on the mission? If your business is trying to make a positive difference in the world, how do you give up control of the business and ensure that that mission goes on? And Ben & Jerry's managed to sign an agreement when it was sold that preserved large portions of its mission. And that story hadn't ever really been told before. And that's one of the big reasons for the book.
What was interesting is for those familiar with the story of Ben and Jerry, so they start out, they have this great mission, and the minute that some success, some great success and some moderate success, people come to look to buy them, right?
Yeah, well, they also managed their business in such a way that their stock price was very low, so they were a bargain target.
Yeah. Yeah. So this was something where that they were fighting against trying to be independent. So for them finally to go through this deal with Unilever, that was momentous, wasn't it?
Yeah, and the board of directors did not want to sell. I mean, they sort of tied one hand behind their back when they became a widely traded public company because, of course, when your stock is publicly traded, a lot of the people who buy the stock are looking for maximum financial return. And if you've got a social mission, then that means that you're taking a temporary bump down in short-term profits to maximize your long-term brand equity. So that was sort of the clash of cultures that forced the sale of the company. It was very traumatic for the founders.
So by the time it came, this sale came about, where were the founders in this? Because Ben and Jerry and the other founders, but we'll get to them in a second, weren't as active in the business anyway, right?
When the sale happened, Jerry was the chairman of the board of directors and Ben was the vice chair. But they had hired a CEO who was a very mainstream corporate guy who did everything right in a traditional business sense to get the costs out of the system, to get the stock price back up, and to get the business back into good financial shape. He was hired in 1997, and by 1999, the financial prospects for the company had improved a great deal. But that attracted people who wanted to buy the stock and sell the company. And the founders didn't want to do that.
Who do you include in the founders? Not just Ben and Jerry.
No, I mean, there are a great number of people built the company besides Ben and Jerry's. Jeff Furman, the current chair of the board of directors, is someone you've already mentioned. He has been involved since before the beginning. And there was a whole cast of characters, really talented people who worked their hearts out for decades. And there hadn't been any attention devoted to them and their work at all before, because Ben and Jerry, they're celebrities, and a lot of people think the whole company is about them. It's hundreds of people.
How active are they now?
Ben & Jerry are sort of paid brand icons right now. They don't have job descriptions, but they are paid by Unilever to represent the brand and to not say anything nasty about Unilever.
Okay. And is that in, because I want to get to the basics of the book here, but is that a challenge for them not to say anything nasty about Unilever?
No, I think less and less. You know, the Ben & Jerry's Unilever relationship was rocky for a long time, but in the last 3 or 4 years, it's really had a renaissance and it's getting better and better, which is one of the reasons I was able to write the book, is that it's a long, complicated story, but it basically has a happy ending.
So Jeff Furman was the guy who wrote the original business plan, as I mentioned in the introduction, and now currently is the chairman of the board of directors. So has spent, I think, in somewhere in the epilogue says he spent half of his life with this company.
Right.
So that's a long relationship. So what is it good to? I would assume it's good to achieve that happy ending that you just alluded to have that constant in the process and to make sure that the mission is not screwed around with.
Well, yeah, Jeff is within the company. He's known as the ampersand in Ben & Jerry's. He's sort of the guy who ties the company together. And Jeff is an interesting guy. He's a good friend of mine, but he's always described himself primarily as a social activist and not as a business executive. So he's consistently brought that focus to Ben & Jerry's. And he, more than anyone else, is the reason why the social mission survived and is doing so well today.
When they went to sign on the dotted line, what was the language that allowed for that social mission to continue?
Okay, this is the part that really hasn't been well told or understood. Ben Cohen negotiated an agreement with Unilever, which allowed Ben & Jerry's to remain as a corporation chartered in Vermont that has an independent board of directors and one shareholder, and Unilever is the shareholder. The shareholder grants the corporation certain rights, and one of them is that this board of directors shall be populated with no input from Unilever, and that it has the legal right to stop any changes in the product formula and also to ensure that Unilever continues hitting very specific spending targets for the social mission. It took a long time to sort of make that relationship work fairly smoothly between Ben & Jerry's and Unilever, and it almost ended up in court. But about 4 or 5 years ago, Unilever started to come around. And the truly interesting thing now is that Unilever's CEO, Paul Polman, is talking more and more the Ben & Jerry's line.
What did they get out of it, Unilever? I mean, in the sense of, is it worth the investment? Is it worth for want of a better term, the hassle of dealing with this business model as compared to their very much corporate wine business model for all of their other properties?
Managing a business with a social mission is a tremendous hassle. And Unilever gets a couple of things out of it. One thing they get is that, and this is an excellent question, because Ben & Jerry's is one of Unilever's most profitable brands. The business makes tons of money. And if it wasn't a highly profitable business, they probably wouldn't be able to get away with having a robust social mission. But the other thing that Unilever gets out of pushing a social mission, not just at Ben & Jerry's, but throughout its massive multinational empire of global food brands, is that it gets the employees of Unilever feeling like they're doing something besides selling soap and shampoo. Unilever has very big, aggressive efforts now for global sanitation, hiring small farmers, eliminating poverty. They've got an aggressive climate change thing, manifesto going. And it's a way of improving employee morale. And I think also corporate social responsibility, when it works right, it gives consumers a way of distinguishing your brand from the competition.
One of the things that impressed me, I mean, just as a customer, as a consumer, that the product didn't change. And I assume that was part of it as well.
Well, there's a story there, and that's in the book, too. The product did change for a while. After Unilever bought it, they started managing Ben & Jerry's like a normal ice cream business and cutting some of the ingredient quality. But the board of directors had the legal right to force them to stop, and they did. and the original product formulas were restored. So yeah, the product has not changed, but that was only because of the sale agreement that set up this independent board of directors.
Are they going to keep having to go back to the original sale agreement? I mean, is there an expiration date on that,
or is that
the end of time?
Yeah, that's the big and really interesting thing here. And a lot of socially responsible businesses have been sold in the last two decades, and all of them have gotten away with something that preserves their social mission for a while, and it always sunsets. But in the case of Ben & Jerry's, this board exists in perpetuity. The people from Vermont are never going away. And so Ben & Jerry's, for the foreseeable future, is going to keep pushing Unilever and pushing this cause of corporate social responsibility and trying to stay edgy and out in front because it's part of their brand identity. It's why people love them.
How much of the ice cream is actually made in Vermont?
Most of it is made in Vermont, but there's about 15 or 20% now is made in Henderson, Nevada, for distribution on the West Coast. And Ben & Jerry's is now becoming more and more of a global brand. It's a big brand in Europe now, so they have a big manufacturing facility in the Netherlands. So I'd say, maybe half, maybe a little less. They're saying that within a few years, most sales of Ben & Jerry's will happen outside of the United States.
Mm. Has it lost any of its sort of rogueness in the sense of, a scoop shop would want to do something and they would be able to become part of a mission within a community to help a particular cause and is that now sidelined by a corporate overlord or are they still given some autonomy?
The old timers will tell you that a lot was lost with the sale that could never be regained. But as a journalist, as an independent journalist, the thing that really attracted me to this story was it's a very big theme in American history is how radical ideas are integrated into the mainstream. And a lot of the things that Ben & Jerry's were doing 20 years ago that were thought of as absolutely crazy are now fairly well-known and mainstream things, like allowing benefits to same-sex partners of employees. They started doing that in 1991.
Right.
So radical depends on where you're standing.
The other thing too is that they were always very good. Ahead of the buy local movement of helping where they were and all of that, and a lot of that has become more fashionable, which I would assume would make the business model a little bit easier.
Supporting small farms was part of the plan from the very beginning. They still get all their milk from co-ops that are near the manufacturing plants, and that's a core part of the three-part mission.
And the neat thing about Ben & Jerry's was it was always kind of fun. It was always had sort of a wink to it.
And irreverent.
And irreverence. And that has, it seems like that has remained.
Yeah. I mean, that is the brand's identity at this point, and it's a big part of why people love it. I mean, one of the founding spirit of the company was Ben & Jerry doing things that people thought were nuts and saying, why not? Why can't I do this? Why can't I have an IPO that's just restricted to residents of the state of Vermont? And people said, well, there really isn't any reason why you can't. So they said, yeah, we'll go ahead and do it. And they did that over and over again. And they're trying to keep that spirit now.
Hmm. When you think about the future's bright. You don't think anything. There's no sort of looming question mark.
Well, I mean, in the food business, things can hit you from. You can get blindsided for all kinds of reasons you can't predict. And I think that there will certainly be a time when the sales of Ben & Jerry's aren't as great as they are now. And whether or not the social mission survives in its current robust form during a sales downturn is another really interesting question that we'll have to wait and see. But there's a culture, and I think Unilever more and more recognizes that promoting a brand with a strong social mission is actually good for business.
The book is fascinating. It's called Ice Cream Social, The Struggle for the Soul of Ben & Jerry's. It is by Brad Edmondson, and the book is out and about. And
Joe, I'll be outside the Ben & Jerry's during Art on Lark.
Excellent.
Selling books.
Right here on Lark Street in Albany, Art on Lark this weekend.
The 7th of June.
June 7th. Excellent.
So come by and get a free ice cream cone.
terrific. Brad, thank you very much for being with us.
You're welcome.
Very, very nice to have you here.
Thanks a lot.
You're listening to The Roundtable on WAMC.